Chapters of Life by Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 4, Many Dimensions 2. It seems rather appropriate to deal with the fourth dimension in the fourth chapter, because when we leave this earth, we all go into the fourth dimension. Let us add an interesting point here. People who attend seances are often upset at the garbled messages they receive from those who have passed over. They do not understand that the person who has left this earth or another plane of existence is what we might term thousands of light years in the future. You will find an interesting parallel later in this chapter when we deal with the Hindu king and his daughter. But first, what is a one-dimensional world? We cannot understand what four dimensions are unless we understand what one is. Suppose we have a piece of paper and a pencil. Let us draw on the paper a straight line, and let us imagine that all the carbon from the pencil represents people, so that, in effect, the straight line is a whole universe. There will be only two points for the people. One is straight ahead, and the other is straight behind. They will be able to move backwards or forwards and in no other way at all. Supposing that you could make a change in that line, then the one-dimensional people would think that a miracle had occurred. Or if they saw the point of your pencil just lightly pressing on the paper, they would think that a flying saucer had suddenly appeared. You, as a three-dimensional creature, will have temporarily entered a one-dimensional world to rest the point of your pencil on the paper. And the one-dimensional being who saw that pencil point will be sure that a most unusual happening has occurred. Being one-dimensional, he would not be able to see you, but only that point of the pencil in contact with the paper. Having some idea of what a one-dimensional world is, let us have a look at a two-dimensional world. This will be a flat plane, and the people who live upon such a world will necessarily be flat, geometrical figures. The world in which they exist will be, to them, much the same as our world, except that if you draw pencil lines around them, they will become aware of these as great walls, preventing them from going beyond those encompassing lines. And they will probably decide that the lines they encounter must exist somewhere else. They will think of the third dimension in much the same way as we think of the fourth dimension, in much the same way as we sometimes have difficulty comprehending the fourth dimension, so will these two-dimensional people have the greatest difficulty in comprehending that third dimension, which to us is so commonplace. In fact, if anything does stir their consciousness about a third dimension, and if they are foolish enough to talk to anyone else about it, they would be put away as lunatics and regarded as liars, phonies, hoaxers, or similar. A two-dimensional being senses lines. They cannot be perceived by this person because, being a two-dimensional person, he will not be able to look from above. If only scientists were not so difficult. If only scientists would put aside all their preconceived notions and enter a research with an absolutely unbiased outlook. We have to face the fact that big names have too much say in everyday affairs. For example, A man had some success as a general in a war, so he's immediately made into the President of the United States. Or we get an actor who pretends that he is a lady killer on the screen. Actually, he's really quite hopeless in that department, but anyway, he had some success on the screen, so we immediately become inundated with photographic comments from the fellow, telling us how we should brush our teeth, how we should cut our hair, what sort of shavers we should use, and possibly helpful hints on a love life which this person could not possibly enjoy. It follows, then, that one of the biggest difficulties, one of the biggest drawbacks, which we metaphysicians have to face, is that people blindly follow the words of those who should know about such things, but probably do not. Take people such as Einstein or Rutherford or those of similar standing. These men are specialists in a particularly narrow field of science. They have the scientific outlook, and they want to analyze everything according to mundane, outmoded concepts and physical laws, which daily are being contradicted. People take the word of eminent scientists as gospel. They take the words of film stars as gospel also. And, unfortunately, the gospel cannot be disputed and cannot be varied. Our problem is to delve into truths which some eminent people have strenuously attempted to conceal. Fundamental laws should be regarded as fundamental, that is, as being valid during the present state of knowledge. But such laws must be sufficiently flexible that they can be altered, amended, or even scrapped in the light of increasing knowledge. Let us remind you of the bumblebee. According to the laws of flight, the laws of aerodynamics, the bumblebee cannot possibly fly because the poor creature's structure completely defies all known laws of aerodynamics. Thus so, if we believe that the bumblebee cannot fly. They, reputable scientists, basing their statements on the law of physics, have said that man would never travel at more than 30 miles an hour because his blood system would break down under the strain. His heart would burst, his brain would collapse, etc., etc. Well, according to recent reports, man can travel at more than 30 miles an hour. Having accomplished that, the scientist said, man would never fly. It was impossible. With that overcome, they said that man would never fly faster than sound. Never mind, undaunted, they said that man would never leave the earth and go into space. And according to rumors, this has been done too. Going back a bit farther, to somewhere about 1910, all the wise men and pundits of science said that no man would send his voice across the Atlantic. But a gentleman by the name of Marconi proved that statement wrong, and now we send not merely voices, but pictures across the Atlantic. But possibly there's not much of an advantage, having due regard to the present-day state of TV programs. Having gotten over to you, more or less, the idea that established scientists with their stereotyped, hidebound, immovable laws can be wrong, let us go a little further. One of their fallacies is that statement that two solids cannot occupy the same space at the same time. That is absurd. That is completely incorrect, for in the science of metaphysics, two bodies can occupy the same space at the same time by a process known as interpenetration. Scientists have shown that everything that exists is composed of atoms with great spaces between them, in much the same way as when we look up at the stars on a clear night, we can see little dots which are worlds and great black spaces which is space. It follows then that if we have a creature small enough, you'll have to stretch your imagination here, to look at what, to us, is a solid, that creature may be able to see not a solid, as we do, but all the particles composing the solid, and then, to that creature, looking at our solid, the view will be similar to that which we see when we look at the heavens on a clear night. To remind you, that is much space with just a few little pinpoints of light. But imagine this, supposing that there was a being large enough so that in looking at our universe, he would see that universe as a solid. At the other end of the scale, think of a virus. If you could catch a virus of a special type, you could drop that single virus into a porcelain cup and the poor creature would fall right through. Would fall right through the bottom without touching anything on the way because it is such a small thing. This is not imagination, but fact. You may be aware that one of the big difficulties in catching a virus in a lab is that the things just go through the ceramic filters, much the same as a dog can run wild on a moor. To a creature small enough, the spaces between atoms in a solid are as great in comparison as those between the stars in our universe, and just as whole showers of meteorites, or comets, or spaceships can travel the empty spaces between the worlds, so can other objects occupy that which we term a solid object. It is quite possible to have two solids, or three or four solids, so arranged that their worlds do not touch each other, but one set of worlds occupies the space between the other set of worlds. You will appreciate that under this system, there could be many apparently solid objects which occupy the same space simultaneously. Obviously, we cannot perceive this in normal life because we do not have a suitable nor an adequate range of perceptions. We need to increase our perceptions, and as here on this world, we cannot easily enter the fourth dimension. We have to accept the printed words of explanation or taped voices of explanation. To give you just a crude idea, suppose you have two forks, ordinary garden forks if you like, or table forks. You can pass the tines of one through the space between the tines of the other. Thus, while one set of tines occupies the space between the other set of tines, the two fork blades occupy what is essentially the same amount of space without impinging upon the living space of the other. Originally, people thought that objects had length and breadth, but then matters improved somewhat and people came to the conclusion that there was length, breadth, and thickness, so that people lived in a three-dimensional world. For example, length is one dimension, breadth is the second dimension and thickness third dimension. But it is quite obvious that we live in a three-dimensional world. There are other dimensions, such as a fourth, a fifth, and so on. To give you something to think about, our three-dimensional object has length, breadth, and thickness. But here's another dimension. How long will it exist? So we have a further dimension of time. Time becomes a fourth dimension in this case. The average person, by way of illustration, cannot see infrared rays without special equipment. This proves, of course, that there are things beyond the range of the average human perceptions, and it follows from this that objects emitting infrared rays and lying in a plane beyond length, breadth, and thickness would be quite invisible to the average person. May we digress for a moment? May we remind you that there are sounds which are quite inaudible to humans, but which cats and dogs hear clearly. The soundless dog whistle, probably everyone knows about that. But if you look at the illustrations in Lesson 6 of my book, You Forever, you will see what we term the symbolic keyboard. You will observe that after sound, we have sight. And there are certain cases in which sounds have been almost seen. Aperceived would be a better term. Because under certain conditions, if a person is very clairvoyant, they can see the shape of sound. You have probably heard someone say, "Oh, that's such a round sound," or something similar, from which we may gather that quite a number of people have an idea of sound as a shape, such as a round sound, a square sound, or a long drawn out sound. But let us get back to the point we were making before we digressed in the previous paragraph. You will need to think of this. A three-dimensional object, such as a house or a person or a tree, casts a two-dimensional shadow. Because the shadow has length and breadth, but no thickness. Of course, in other planes of existence, we should say that the shadow also has a further dimension, that of time, the time of its enduring. But let us forget that for a moment and go back and say that a three-dimensional object casts a two-dimensional shadow. We can assume that a fourth-dimensional object would show a shadow of three dimensions. So those of you who have seen a ghost may actually have seen the shadow of a person in the fourth dimension. A ghost is a person who has apparent breadth, thickness, and height, but is of somewhat shadowy substance, as shadowy as a shadow, in fact. So why should it not be that our four-dimensional visitor, who's invisible to us because of his four dimensions, nevertheless manifests to us in three dimensions, or as a ghost which has form without substantial substance? Consider further reports of objects which the press rather foolishly call flying saucers. These objects have appeared and disappeared at fantastic speeds and without any sound at all. They've changed direction at a speed far beyond that of a human body. Now, why should we not suppose that some flying saucers may be the shadow of a fourth dimensional object? Consider their rate of change of direction. Consider holding a mirror in your hand and focusing the sun's rays on a wall. You can make that blob of light dance about and change direction at a rate far in excess of that which any human mechanism could manage. Again, imagine a sheet of frosted glass facing a person or entity who had no conception of the appearance of a human being. Then, supposing the human who was concealed at the opposite side of the sheet of frosted glass, put four fingers and a thumb in contact with the glass. The person on the other side, knowing nothing of the shape of humans, would see five blobs, five dark smears, just as some people have seen blobs in the sky. You may wonder, what has all this got to do with metaphysics? Well, it has a very great deal to do with metaphysics. You see, we live in a three-dimensional world, but the highest form of truth can be perceived only when we go beyond a three-dimensional world. We have to go beyond time and space, for time is relative. Time is merely a convention established by mankind to suit his own convenience. You think that time is not relative? All right. Supposing that you have to go to the dentist and you have to have a tooth or teeth extracted. When you're having your aches and pains, time appears to stand still. It appears that you're in that dental chair forever. Now you have a very enjoyable experience with the person to whom you're deeply attached. You find then that time flies. So time is just a relative thing. It appears to drag or hasten abominably according to our mood. Well, back into our dimensions. Let us suppose that there are some form of people who live only in a two-dimensional world. That is, they live on a world on which there is length and breadth, but no depth. They're like shadows. They are thinner than the thinnest sheet of paper, but having no perception of depth, they can have no perception of space, because space is that which is beyond the sky, and to bring in the sky would be to bring in a third dimension. Thus, to them, space is inconceivable. A railroad track is similar to a world of one dimension, length. A train conductor could indicate his position from just one point of reference. He could say where he was by referring to the known location of a station or from a signal or from some other well-known landmark. Let us go farther and agree that a ship upon the sea is as a person occupying a two-dimensional world, for the ship is not confined to rails, but it can go forward or sideways or even backwards. So it has the use of length and width. An airplane is a creature of three dimensions. It can go forward, sideways, and up or down. That, you will perceive, gives us the three dimensions. This theory, actually to us it's knowledge, of dimensions will explain many things which otherwise must be considered as a mystery. Teleportation, for example, in which an object is moved from one room to another without any visible person doing the moving. An object can be moved by teleportation from a locked room to another room. Actually, it's quite simple, because we merely have to think of our two-dimensional being. If we three-dimensionals had a series of boxes without any tops to them, the two-dimensional people who could be in those boxes would be completely confined, completely enclosed, because Not having any conception of height, they would not know that there was no roof above them. And so, if we three-dimensional creatures reached in through the open roof and moved something from one box to another, it would, to the two-dimensional people, be an absolute miracle in which an object in one secured room was moved to another secured room. Remember, the two-dimensional person would have no conception of the roof above. In just the same way, we three-dimensional people could have no conception of an opening which is quite clear in the fourth dimension, so that the person in the fourth dimension could reach down into a locked room, for the room would be locked in three dimensions only, and move that which he desired to move through what was an opening clear to four-dimensional people. The object would be moved from the three-dimensional world and, for a moment, would be in the fourth-dimensional world, where it would penetrate through what we prefer to call solid walls. We have something of an illustration when we think of the way that radio or TV waves can penetrate apparently solid walls and still activate a radio or television receiver. Time, to which we've already referred, plays a very important part in the life of man, but that which we call time differs from man to man and animal to animal. Again, we suggest that you think about this under different conditions in your everyday life. When you are late for an appointment, you see how the hand races around the clock face. When you're expecting someone and he or she, usually more she, keeps you waiting, time appears to stand still. Animals have their own conception of time, and their conception of time is quite different from that of humans. Animals live at a different rate. An insect which lives for 24 hours of human time can still have as full a life as a human living for 70 years. The insect can have a mate, can raise a family, see its own family have their families in turn. If the allotted span of an animal is 20 years, those 20 years will appear as 70 years or so appears to a human. And within the space allotted to the animal, he will be able to function just as a man could function in his longer lifespan. It is worth a thought that all creatures, insect, animal, or human, have approximately the same number of heartbeats in a lifetime. All this about time was readily understood by the wise men of centuries ago. There is a very holy book, one of the great Bibles of the Far East, which is called the Srimad Bhagavat, in which appears this. Once a great king took his daughter to the home of the creator, Brahma, who lived in a different dimension. The great king was most concerned that his daughter had arrived at a marriageable age and still had not found an acceptable suitor. The great king was anxious to find a good husband for his daughter. After arriving at the home of Brahma, he had to wait for just a very few moments before he could be escorted into the presence and thus make his request. To his intense amazement, Brahma replied, "O king, when you go back to earth, you will not see any of your friends or relatives, your cities or your palaces. For although it seems to you that you arrived here only a few moments ago from the earth you knew, yet Those few moments of our time are the equivalent of several thousand years of your time when you were on the Earth. When you go back to Earth, you will find that there is a new age, and your daughter, whom you've brought here, will marry Lord Krishna's brother, Balarama. Thus, she who was born thousands of years ago will be married to Balarama after several thousand more years, because in just the time it takes for you to leave my presence and journey again through time to Earth, several thousand years of Earth time will have passed. And so the bemused king and his daughter returned to the Earth, which, according to their own estimate of time, they had only left a few minutes before. They found what appeared to be a new world with what appeared to be a new civilization, a different type of people, a different culture, and a different religion. So, as he had been told, several thousand years had passed in the time of Earth, although he and his daughter, traveling to a different dimension, had seen but a few minutes pass. This is a Hindu belief which was written in the holy books of the Hindu faith thousands of years ago. One cannot help wondering if this is not possibly the foundation of some of the things that Dr. Einstein produced as the theory of relativity. Probably you have not fully studied Einstein's theory of relativity, but, very, very briefly, he explained time as a fourth dimension. He also taught that time is not a steady and varying flow of something. He realized that a second ticked on. After 60 such second ticks, a minute had passed. And after 60 minute ticks, an hour had passed. But that is convenient time. That is mechanical time. Einstein considered time as a sense, as a form of perception. Just as no two people see precisely the same colors, so Einstein taught that no two people have precisely the same sense of time. We call a year 365 days, but it is just a trip around the sun, an orbit around the sun. So we, upon the Earth, do an orbit of the sun roughly every 365 days. But compare this with a person who lives on Mercury. Remember that Mercury completes its orbit around the sun in 88 days, and during that orbit, it rotates just once upon its axis, whereas, as you know, we upon Earth rotate once in 24 hours. Something else for you to ponder. Do you know that if a clock be attached to a moving system, it will slow down as that moving system's velocity increases? Supposing that you have a rod made of some material, metal, wood, ceramic, anything you like, but it is a definite measuring rod of a definite length. If you attach that to any moving system, it will apparently shrink in the direction of its motion according to the velocity of the system. All these things, such as changes in the clock or the contraction of the rod, are not in any way to do with the construction of things, nor are they of a mechanical phenomena. They are instead to do with the Einstein theory of relativity. You may have your meter stick. Let us say that our metal rod was 1 meter or 1 yard long. So now, if it goes through space at 90% of the velocity of light, it will shrink to half a meter, and in theory, If its speed is increased until it moves at the speed of light, it would, according to the Einstein theory of relativity, shrink to nothing at all. And if somehow you could tie a clock of some kind to that meter stick, its rate of timekeeping would vary so that, as the meter stick approached the speed of light, the clock would go more and more slowly, or would appear to, until, at the speed of light, the clock would stop completely. You must remember, when you criticize this, by saying, "Oh well, I have driven the car and I haven't seen the car contract," that these changes can be detected only when the speed of the moving article approaches near to the speed of light. So, if you have a brand new car and you race along the road, it doesn't mean to say that your car is going to get any shorter, because no matter if you can do 100 or 120 miles an hour, that speed is still all too slow to make any measurable difference in the length of your car. But it does mean, according to Einstein, that if a spaceship should be sent into space and it could approach the speed of light, then it would contract and disappear. Do you know what that means, assuming that Einstein's right? We, being able to do astral travel, we know that Einstein is wrong, just as were those scientists who said that man could never exceed the speed of sound. Einstein is wrong, just as wrong as the person who said man would never exceed 30 miles an hour. But we have to learn by the mistakes of others. It might save us from having mistakes of our own. So let us see what would happen according to the theory of Einstein. Let us say that we have a spaceship and the crew in the spaceship are all wise men who are able to make accurate observations. The ship is traveling at a very high speed indeed, almost approaching the speed of light. The ship is going to a distant planet, so distant that it would take 10 years to reach from the Earth to that other planet. A light year is the time and distance it takes light to reach a certain point by traveling one full year. So, 10 light years is the time it takes light to reach that distant object. This ship is going to travel at about the speed of light. Let us forget all about Einstein for the moment and let us say that this ship can travel at the speed of light. So, supposing the ship is going 10 light years to this distant planet, and then, without stopping, it's going to come back. After all, as we are supposing, anything is permissible. Thus, we have a journey that will last for 20 years, 10 years out and 10 years back. Well, naturally, the poor fellows aboard are going to be frightfully bored, shut up like that for 20 years. And not only that, but they're certainly going to need a whole pile of food and drink with them. Anyhow, we're just supposing. Now, if you are to believe Einstein, there won't be these difficulties. They won't need food for 20 years. If the ship is going to travel at even close to the speed of light, everything aboard the ship will slow down. The men will be slow in all their functions, their heartbeats, their breathing, their physical action, and even their thoughts. Whereas with us, a thought may take a tenth of a second. When traveling at the speed of light, according to Einstein, it might take 10 seconds for a thought on Earth, but 10 weeks for the duration of the same thought when traveling near the speed of light. But traveling at the speed of light is going to have certain very important advantages, according to Einstein. For example, 20 years on Earth would pass, but to the people in the spaceship, it would just be a matter of a very few hours. Do you want to have a better illustration than that? All right. In 1970, we have made a spaceship which will travel at almost the speed of light. The ship is outfitted and ready to go on a journey far beyond our solar system, far beyond Mars, Venus, Jupiter, Pluto, Saturn, and all of them. It's going, instead, to a different universe. And it's going to take, at the speed of light, 20 years. In 1970, then, the spaceship lifts off. It does 10 years traveling to this far distant world. It circles, takes some photos, and then it returns. Another journey of 10 years. 20 years in all. The crew are young men. One of them is just 20 years of age when he leaves on that eventful journey. He's married and his wife is the same age as he, 20 years. They have a child 1 year of age. When the poor fellow returns, after just a few hours of traveling at near the speed of light, he will get the biggest shock of his life. He will find that his wife is 20 years older than him. While he and other members of the crew have aged just a few hours, the others left upon the Earth have aged by the temporal time, that is, 20 years. So this man of 20 and a few hours now has a wife of 40. Here is an incident which the United States very much desires to keep quiet and out of the public knowledge. This particular matter which follows is absolutely authentic, absolutely genuine, and those who are sufficiently high placed may be able to dig into some of the United States naval records. In October 1943, an attempt was made to render a ship of the United States Navy invisible. This had disastrous results because some of the scientists were so hidebound that they could not use their imagination but had to go by the book. You will remember that in the Second World War, the United States, as well as other people, advertised for ideas of how to make super weapons, etc. One idea was, as a result of Professor Einstein's letter to President Roosevelt, in which the unified field theory was set out in some detail. There is no point in going into the technical aspects of the unified field, but we might say that it does embrace a certain amount of knowledge about the fourth dimension. A certain doctor of science, a very clever man indeed, used part of the theorems relating to the unified field, and working in conjunction with the United States Navy in October 1943, he was able to make a shield, a type of ray, which completely encompassed a destroyer. The field would extend about 300 feet from its center of origin, and anything inside that field became completely invisible. So that to the observer outside, the ship and crew disappeared. Unfortunately, when the ship again became visible, many of the crew were insane. It seems that, examining physicians afterwards, use sodium pentothal to try to dig down into the subconsciousness of crew members to find out exactly what happened. From our point of view, and in connection with the fourth dimension, it seems that, on one occasion, the invisible ship reappeared several hundred miles away in Chesapeake Bay. It is a pity that people in the area cannot go to the public libraries and consult the files of the local newspapers, or get hold of some of the records in such a book as M.K. Jessup and the Yolenda Letters, compiled by Riley Crabb. A book was apparently published by Gray Barker in the United States called The Strange Case of Dr. Jessup. This is a very serious discussion. This is not a hoax or even hearsay evidence. The United States government have gone to great trouble to try to silence anyone who has discussed such things as this, and there have been reports of people dying mysteriously after having been in possession of certain information. The United States government also seems to have had some success in silencing the press. For that, surely they deserve the Nobel Prize and a few Oscars thrown in for good measure. But it does indicate that there is much in this invisible ship business. There has been one report inadvertently released, which says that the invisible ship materialized in a port, and some quite bemused sailors staggered ashore and fairly tumbled into a public house. They were seen by perhaps 30 or 40 people, and in mid-sentence, while they were ordering drinks, they disappeared. Disappeared, vanished, went into thin air. People who are sufficiently interested should read the books mentioned above and should also try to find some method of combing newspapers around 1944 and 1956. There are hints, and in two instances, actual reports. It is clear that if one could suddenly switch a ship or a special weapon into the fourth dimension and then bring it back to the third dimension at some designated spot, the Chinese could be suppressed very thoroughly. It might even give the Russians a few frights. People laughed about the laser beam, but that little ruby light has proved to be all that was claimed for it, and a few things besides. So if research would only be continued with suitable safeguards, it would be found that documents solidly locked in a bank vault could be removed by way of the fourth dimension, because remember, if a thing has four walls to you, that is because you are in a three-dimensional world, and in a fourth dimension, there may be an opening through which one could enter. Returning to this matter of the invisible ship, it is thought that if the men had been conditioned to know what to expect, they would not have gone insane, because the horrid shock of finding oneself in a different time continuum is enough to unhinge anyone's mind unless they are preconditioned. Many, many years ago, in the days of Plato, there was discussion about the fourth dimension, but even in those days, scientists were not able to perceive that which was metaphorically perched on the end of their noses. Plato had a dialogue which seems to be rather applicable to this discussion about the fourth dimension, and so, as it is essential that in order that we may obey the commandment, man, know thyself, we must understand the relationship of the different dimensions, the first, the second, the third, and the fourth. So, let us have here, to end this chapter, the dialogue of Plato the philosopher and how he tried to make it clear to people that which was so obvious to him. Behold, human beings living in a sort of underground den. They have been there from their childhood, and they have their legs and necks chained. The chains are arranged in such a manner as to prevent them from turning their heads. At a distance above and behind them, the light of a fire is blazing, and between the fire and the prisoner there is a raised way, and you will see, if you look, a low wall built along the way, like the screen which puppet players have before them, over which they show the puppets. Imagine men passing along the wall carrying vessels, which appear over the wall. Also, figures of men and animals made of wood and stone and various materials, and some of the passengers, as you would expect, are talking, and some of them are silent. "That is a strange image," he said, "and they are strange prisoners." "Like ourselves," I replied, "and they see only their own shadows, or the shadows of one another, which the fire throws on the opposite wall of the cave." "True," he said. "How could they see anything but the shadows if they were never allowed to move their heads?" "And of the objects which are being carried in like manner, they would only see the shadows?" "Yes," he replied. "And if they were able to talk with one another, would they not suppose that they were naming what was actually before them?" "Very true." "And suppose further that the prison had an echo which came from the other side, would they not be sure to fancy that the voice which they heard was that of a passing shadow?" "No question," he replied. "There can be no question," I said, "that the truth would be to them just nothing but the shadows of the images." "That is certain." "And now look again and see how they are released and cured of their folly. At first, when any of them is liberated and compelled suddenly to go up and turn his neck around and walk and look at the light, he will suffer sharp pains. The glare will distress him, and he will be unable to see the realities of which in his former state he had seen shadows, and then imagine someone saying to him that which he saw before was an illusion, but that now he is approaching real being and has a truer sight and a vision of more real things, what will be his reply? And you may further imagine that his instructor is pointing to the objects as they pass and requiring him to name them. Will he not be in a difficulty? Will he not fancy that the shadows which he formerly saw are truer than the objects which are now shown to him? Far truer. And if he is compelled to look at the light, will he not have a pain in his eyes, which will make him turn away to take refuge in the object of vision which he can see, and which he will conceive to be clearer than the things which are now being shown to him? True. And suppose, once more, that he is reluctantly dragged up a steep and rugged ascent and held fast and forced into the presence of the sun himself. Do you not think that he will be pained and irritated, and when he approaches the light, he will have his eyes dazzled and will not be able to see any of the realities which are now affirmed to be the truth? Not all in a moment, he said. He will require to get accustomed to the sight of the upper world, and first he will see the shadows best. Next, the reflections of men and other objects in the water, and then the objects themselves, Next, he will gaze upon the light of the moon and the stars, and he will see the sky and stars by night better than the sun, or the light of the sun by day. Certainly. And at last, he will be able to see the sun, and not mere reflections of him in the water, but he will see him as he is in his own proper place, and not in another, and he will contemplate his nature. Certainly. And after this, he will reason that the sun is he who gives the seasons and the years, and is the guardian of all that is in the visible world, and in a certain way the cause of all things which he and his fellows have been accustomed to behold. Clearly, he said, he would come to the other first, and to this afterwards. And when he remembered his old habitation, and the wisdom of the den and his fellow prisoners, do you not suppose that he would felicitate himself on the change and pity them? He certainly would. And if they were in the habit of conferring honors on those who were quickest to observe and remember and foretell which of the shadows went before and which followed after, and which were together, do you think he would care for such honors and glories or envy of the possessors of them? Would he not say with Homer, "Better to be a poor man and have a poor master and endure anything than to think and live after their manner"? Yes, he said, I think he would rather suffer anything than live after their manner. Imagine once more, I said, that such a one, coming suddenly out of the sun, were to be put back in his old situation. Is he not certain to have his eyes full of darkness? Very true, he said. And if there were a contest, and he had to compete in measuring the shadows with the prisoners who have never moved out of the den during the time that his sight is weak, and before his eyes are steady, and the time which would be needed to acquire this new habit of sight might be very considerable, would he not be ridiculous? Men would say of him that up he went and down he comes without his eyes, and that there was no use in even thinking of ascending. And if anyone tried to loose another and lead him up to the light, let them only catch the offender in the act, and they would put him to death. No question, he said. This allegory, I said, you may now append to the previous argument. The prison is the world of sight. The light of the fire is the sun. The ascent and vision of the things above you may truly regard as the upward progress of the soul into the intellectual world. And you will understand that those who attain to this beatific vision are unwilling to descend to human affairs, but their souls are ever hastening into the upper world in which they desire to dwell. And is there anything surprising in one who passes from divine contemplation to human things, misbehaving himself in a ridiculous manner? Now, there's nothing surprising in that, he replied. Anyone who has common sense will remember that the bewilderments of the eyes are of two kinds, and arise from two causes, either from coming out of the light or from going into the light, which is true of the mind's eye quite as much as the bodily eye. And he who remembers this when he sees the soul of anyone whose vision is perplexed and weak will not be too ready to laugh. He will first ask whether the soul has come out of the brighter life and is unable to see because he's unaccustomed to the dark, or, having turned from darkness to the day, is dazzled by excess of light and then he will count one happy in his condition and state of being. A note from Blue Friend. The ship that turned invisible was the USS Eldridge, and it was called the Philadelphia Experiment. End of chapter 4.